You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When he was just 5 years old, Alan Arkin told his father that he was going to be an actor. Since then, Mr. Arkin has devoted his life to the pursuit of the perfect performance on the stage as an Academy Award-winning movie actor and as a director in over 80 roles for the stage and screen. He writes about his approach to acting and the formative experiences that molded him into the actor he became in a memoir he's called An Improvised Life. It's published by DeCapo Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Alan Arkin to our show.
Well, thank you, Leonard. Nice to be here.
How does any kid know if he wants to be what he wants to be at the age of five, other than a fireman or policeman?
Beats me. I have no idea.
So why did you, what led you to tell your father that you wanted to be an actor, keep it a secret, and then whisper it to him?
I haven't got a clue. I was five. You have to ask him.
You have to ask that five-year-old.
Yeah, three.
But you do remember doing this.
I remember mainly my father telling other people about it. I don't remember actually saying it, but it sounds like it could very well have been me.
So, but do you remember wanting to be anything else, or was it always
No, I've never wanted to be anything else until very recently.
And what have you wanted to be more?
Just
recently?
About anything. I just like hanging. I'm very fond of hanging out these days, talking, chewing the fat with people.
Well, also, it's obvious that you're enjoying writing because although, and we'll get into this later, you didn't do very well when you had to write when you were in college.
No, I didn't.
You've written a bunch of books. You've written a play.
Yeah. That was by complete accident. I wrote a play by accident. I had no intention of writing a play, but there it was.
In the book, you talk about being unmoved by a friend of your mother's who was crying because her performance was too full of self-pity. How old were you at the time?
I guess about probably seven. I know it's a little bit insane, but then actors are insane in their own way. That was my way of being insane.
And you say that because you were focusing on acting at an early age, you were able to forego some of the typical developmental stages. Instead of asking, who am I, you could just play a part.
Yeah, so no, I didn't ask who am I asked who are they.
And were you always playing a part when you were a kid, do you think?
Yeah, and it lasted much too long. I feel like I was performing for a lot of my life until I was well into my 30s.
I guess this is why people go into psychotherapy, to finally say, who am I?
That's right. That's why I went into it. And he didn't have a clue, so I started pursuing that question in other places.
Well, if you can become other people, isn't that fine? A lot of actors say that this is part of the joy of acting. You don't have to worry about
you
are.
I also think it's a kind of arrested development, and I think it can be a serious psychological aberration if it goes too far.
And you say that you were using it as what you call a protection mechanism. Protecting against what?
Against that question, who am I? I think a lot of people, particularly actors, don't think there's anybody inside once they start asking that question. But what I found out is there is somebody inside, and to me it's gotten a lot more interesting than the characters I've been playing.
Do you think that your acting changed once you started focusing on your own self-development and not just on the personalities of the characters you were playing?
Yeah, and I was worried for a long time that it would be evident if I saw what I was doing. I thought that my work would suffer for it, but looking at it, I don't feel like it really has particularly.
But you studied with a student of Stanislavski's,
right.
And isn't the whole Stanislavski method about finding yourself within a character?
You always find yourself in a character, no matter how far afield you think you're going.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a serial killer, you don't have to be a serial killer but you do have to find certain things in you that would
correspond
connect
to that. Yeah, and but I think that happens whether people like it or not, whether they're working with the Stanislavski method or not. Sooner or later, I think a part of the character you're playing seeps into you, and I think it's unavoidable. And I don't like it particularly anymore. It doesn't make me particularly happy. I don't want to. It didn't make me happy a long time ago. I did a movie where I I tortured Audrey Hepburn, and I just didn't like it because I was so enamored of her as a person that it wasn't fun for me. So it's the kind of thing I'm more and more careful of these days. I don't want to play people that I can't stand.
Well, there's that other side.
And I can't stand anybody.
Well, that's the big problem. There are those actors that come out of the Stanislavski method who really take it very literally, the famous story of Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier. And then there's Rod Steiger wearing silk women's underwear when he played the sergeant in a movie where – I mean, he had to wear it all the time. He couldn't just make believe he had it.
I would like to say right now publicly that I have never worn ladies' silk underwear, nor do I have any intention of ever wearing ladies.
No, I went through this whole thing looking for that.
If a director says to me, I want you to wear ladies' silk underwear for this part, I'm going to say no. I will refuse to wear ladies' silk underwear.
So what did
I have nothing against ladies nor ladies' silk underwear, but I am just not going to put them on.
So what did you learn from Benjamin Zemak?
What I learned from him? I learned the difference between showing off and performing and getting into the emotional life of a character.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that you can apply to not just to acting but to life, can't you?
What?
Because that also allows you to empathize, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I don't want to be it anymore. I'd like to be able to empathize with somebody without jumping into their emotional life particularly. And it's mainly because I like my own these. I mean, I've learned how to like myself, which maybe is a danger for an actor, but it's nice.
Although you profess to never really have had much use for school, nonetheless, you attended Bennington on a scholarship for 2 years. That was an all-girls school at the time, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
So
and
how did you get in?
There's a sitcom in that. How did I get in? They had four guys on campus to be in the plays in the drama department. You were allowed to take courses and matriculate even if you were so able to. I was not, but I was in a lot of plays and I learned a lot about acting from a wonderful teacher they had there named Larry Arick.
And you make it sound like otherwise, all you did was drink martinis.
I was plied with them by the instructors and the students there. So what could I do? I was on an allowance of $1 a month from my parents, who were broke at the time, and I had to eat something.
But still, it seems to me like this is a fantasy to be one of four male students at an all-girls school.
It was kind of a fantasy, and there's a sitcom in it if I ever... If I ever have the courage to write it.
On the other hand, you only lasted 2 years.
Yeah.
Because you just couldn't take care of the academic side?
In essence, yeah. I was under the impression that I would get a degree, which I thought would please my parents, and it turned out that my grades weren't good enough to reach such a noble goal, so I quit in a huff.
My guest is Alan Arkin, who's written a memoir called An Improvised Life. It's published by DeCapo. Didn't Bennington ask you relatively recently to give their commencement address?
Yeah. It was about 15 years ago they asked me to.
Everything is relative.
Right. And I said to the dean, I said, I feel funny giving a commencement address here. I got kicked out of Bennington. And the dean said, so did I. So that ended that.
But you didn't give the address.
No, I the idea of writing a speech was anathema to me. I said I'd be delighted to do something here, but I'm not going to write a speech. So I did an extemporaneous talk with mostly question and answers for the student body one time, which was deeply moving to me because I felt like a college that I didn't make it in asking me back to speak with them was almost more than I can handle emotionally. And then I did my first improvisational workshop. I taught an improvisational workshop there of 35 kids for 10 days, and it was an enormously moving experience for me and the kids as well. So I started doing a series of them after that.
They really opened themselves up.
And I
always wonder about that. People will tell you things in improvisations that they would never tell you any other time.
Exactly. But it was a deeply creative experience for the kids because you're not only acting, but you're writing your own material as you go along, and it, whether you like it or not, it's very self-exploratory. And
it's almost like psychodrama, isn't it?
Well, in my workshops, somebody will once in a while yell out, hey, this is nothing but psychodrama. And I, for a long time, I had no answer to that. And then when somebody yelled that out once, somebody else in the group said, everything is psychodrama. And of course, that's the answer. All of life is psychodrama. So why not my workshops?
So you leave Bennington, and instead of becoming an actor, you join the Terriers.
Because I couldn't get any acting work. So.
Why was that? You sound like you were pretty good. And you couldn't do anything else?
I couldn't get arrested in New York until I was I couldn't get arrested in New York until I was successful in Second City in Chicago, and then I got arrested in New York. No, I didn't get arrested in New York, but I started being able to get work once people saw that I could improvise.
So there you were with the Terriers, you singing and playing guitar?
Right, yeah.
And you even had something of a hit, right?
We had a pretty sizable hit in the Banana Boat song.
Harry Belafonte, Deo?
I'm not Harry Belafonte, no.
But I mean, he also had a hit with that.
Well, song. Yeah, what it was... vaguely interesting to me then, not so much anymore. He had a version of it on an album, which we had never heard. We stole ours from a Jamaican folk song and had a hit with it, so he decided he was going to change the name of his song to what we had, so we chased each other up the charts for about 6 months, and he finally won.
But you were a successful group. You toured Europe.
Right.
What made you leave?
I looked down at myself at the we were doing very well at the Olympia Theater in Paris, and I looked down at myself with an open sport shirt on and satin pants and a guitar strapped around my neck, and I said, "What the hell am I doing? I have to be an actor."
And so, you wound up joining the Second City, you said, but you actually turned them down. This is when it was just forming?
Yeah. I didn't know who they were or what they were. They didn't know who they were or what they were, and I didn't want to bury myself in Chicago, which nobody had ever heard of. It was someplace in the Midwest, I knew, and it was a little tiny theater group opening up, and I said, "No fat chance, I'm going to have a career in New York as an actor." And I starved for another year and then called them up in despair and said, if the job is still open, I'll take it. So I took it, and it was the beginning of everything instead of the end of everything.
Because the title of this book is An Improvised Life, and I'm assuming that comes out of that experience. Is improv really what turned things around for you as an actor?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it was getting in a group where I could flourish, where I could experiment. It was the greatest training ground for an actor that anybody could ever hope for. Because in the course of an evening, you'd be playing 10, 15, 20 characters a night sometimes. And we were allowed to fail, which is a bad word in this culture.
And some of the people who have come out of Second City have continued playing those characters. They develop characters, and then they play them the rest of their lives, like Pee Wee Herman.
Was Pee Wee Herman in Second City?
I think he was.
No, I think he was in The Groundlings.
Okay.
Yeah.
Same idea, isn't it?
Well, he's actually really versatile. He's a very versatile actor. I've seen him do like a half a dozen different kinds of things.
Martin Short has done a number of the and many others.
Yep.
But you haven't done that? Did you develop any characters that were kind of important for you as you went on in your career?
Yeah, I found there was a character I played, a Puerto Rican kid that we did a short film of, Andrew Duncan and I, that ended up getting filmed, and then we won an Academy Award nomination for it. And I think he was the basis of a movie I did called Poppy a few years later. Mm.
You mentioned that the troupe once performed for Groucho Marx while you were in New York.
Yeah.
And he attempted to inject himself into the bit.
Attempted. He completely did. He ruined our evening to our great delight. We were doing a thing called the Khrushchev Kennedy debates. I was playing Khrushchev, and Andrew Duncan was playing Kennedy. And I wore, for some reason that I still don't understand, one of the kind of a cab driver's hat. And we asked questions from the audience, and Groucho raised his hand. How could we not ask him what the question was? He said, Yeah, I said, Mr. Khrushchev, where did you get that hat? And we answered, and he just kept answering, asking question after question about the hat. And he ended up making us completely hysterical, and we ran off the stage.
On the other hand, you could say Groucho Marx joined Second City.
Exactly, yeah. But he came backstage afterwards, and we hung out with him for a couple of hours to our immense delight, and he and I became friends, which was one of the joys of my life.
Have you ever gone back?
Have I what?
Gone back to Second City? Sat in with them?
Yeah, occasionally, yeah. I won't improvise with them. It's a whole different style now, and I don't think I could do what they're doing now.
My guest is Alan Arkin, a Brooklyn boy, we're proud to say, although he lives in New Mexico now. He's an Academy Award-winning actor, director, musician. Well, you didn't win an Academy Award for music. But anyway, he also written children's books and starred in over 80 movies. He's written a memoir called An Improvised Life. It's published by DiCapo, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
You going to be home in about an hour?
Why?
I want to make sure we get that engraving out of your house.
What engraving?
Last night I thoughtlessly left one in your basement.
An engraving from the bag?
In my haste.
In my basement?
Why are you getting so excited?
Why am I getting so excited? The central piece of evidence of the biggest federal crime since the atomic spy case is sitting in my basement. You want to know why I'm getting excited?
Go back to your lunches. Do I meddle in your business?
I want that thing out of my house!
Shelley. I'm getting to that. Sit down. Finish
it. I don't want to sit down. I don't want my soup.
You hardly touched
it. Stop with the soup!
My guest is Alan Arkin, and we just heard a scene from The In-Laws, in which he performed with Peter Falk. You write in the book that it was the first time that you really just had fun while you were acting. What had been happening all that time before?
My life was at stake. Every time I did a scene, every time I did a shot, every time I went on stage at Second City, I felt my life was at stake all the time. And The In-Laws was the first time in my life that I was able to just relax and just enjoy it and feel like I had a right to.
Do you think that the audience realized that you and Peter were having such a good time?
Yes, I know they did. And I also know that it matters to an audience whether you're having a good time or not, which surprised me for a long time. But I spent a lot of time thinking about that and why.
Well, you devote a fair amount of space in this book to discussing the difficulties of finding or observing truth in acting. What do you mean by that?
Something's either happening or it's not happening. Something is either like I tell my students in the workshops. I said, the only thing that gives me a right to be conducting this workshop is I feel like I can have a sense of when something is really happening or when it's pretending to happen. And the thing that informs me that is my rear end. And that if something's not happening, I can sit back in my chair and look at it and be amused, but I'm not really engaged. If I'm engaged in a scene, if something is really occurring, then I start sitting forward.
Do you think that acting has changed over the years? When I look at older films, there are a few actors that stand out who really feel like they're just being the character they're playing, but so many of them do appear to be acting. And then something happens. I don't know. Maybe it's the result of Marlon Brando's success or something else that happens at a certain point. And now even kid actors are brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, in the past, kid actors were always, Mr. Arkin, I'm so happy to be here.
Well, still, even though in the 30s, there were still some great kid actors, like Shirley Temple was sensational.
But she was an anomaly. Yeah. Spencer Tracy was a great actor, a few others, but so many actors look like they're acting in those old films.
Yeah, but they also look like they were having a good time. I don't mind it so much when I feel like they're having – like Cary Grant looked like he was having a ball.
Oh, yeah, but he, I think he may have been the greatest movie actor that ever lived.
Oh, he was just wonderful. I'm absolutely enthralled by his work. Nowadays, I feel like almost everybody's capable of being, in quotes, natural, but I feel like a lot of it's fake. I feel like it's a lot of easy kind of effortless naturalism that doesn't have any real thought behind it.
Well, you mentioned that gauging the truth in other people's acting is easy, but it's difficult to observe it in your own performances. Why do you think that is?
I don't follow the question.
If you can spot people being real, that truth that you're looking for, having it, you say that it's not so easy to spot it when you're doing it, when you're performing yourself.
I think these days I can fairly well tell when I'm on and when I'm not off. I know when it's like I know you're really cooking when you come off of a scene and you don't care what anybody says about it. It makes absolutely no difference if somebody likes it or doesn't like it. I know when I'm being truthful and when I'm not, I think.
Well, isn't this why so many people prefer to act on the stage? But you say that you don't love the stage. You may be one of the two or three actors I've spoken to in my lifetime who says that he prefers being in movies.
Prefer being in movies? Let me put it this way. If somebody told me I could rehearse for 2 days and be in a play for 3 days and earn $100 million, I'd tell them I'd think about it for about 6 months and then say no. That's how much I want to be on stage.
Why?
Because to me it's not creative. It's the joy has never been the applause or being in front of an audience. The joy has been to create and invent. And I think after 6 weeks in a play, the invention is, for me, it's just dead.
So is that what happened with Enter Laughing?
Yeah.
You won a Tony for that?
Yeah.
But in some plays you see the actors changing all the time. So some days the character's a bit more troubled, or they give you a different response to something that that you don't expect, and that's part of the fun of doing it live. Isn't
well,
it?
Then do it. It's fine with.
But you do direct plays.
No, I haven't directed in a while. You have to sit in the dark for a long time.
And that bothers you.
I don't want to sit in the dark for a month.
So, but you have been in over 80 films.
Yeah.
But interestingly, you don't spend much time talking about them in the book.
I don't talk about what?
The films, all those 80 films that you were in.
Well, the book was about what I learned from things. There's a lot of films I was in that I may have loved, but I didn't particularly learn anything about the craft. A lot of the book is about what I've learned about the craft and also how I learned to apply it to life in some way.
Well, the book is called a memoir, but it does come across as more of an actor's manifesto. You don't go much into your personal life, your ex-wives, your
doesn't
personal
matter.
Relationships
I,
with your children, your parents.
I do go into personal relationships with each of my kids, but in relationship to their work, yeah, and what we learned from each other and from being in things with each other. Yeah, I don't feel like, first of all, I feel my personal life matters much. I don't think like people may be interested or not, but I don't care. I don't think it informs anything. I wanted to do something that had some possibility for informing something.
You also admit to an ambivalent relationship to your fans and their praise.
No more than I do to having an ambivalent relationship to anybody else, whether they're fans or not. It depends on how I'm approached. If I'm approached like I owe people something, then it's slightly annoying.
And that happens a lot. People come up to actors when they're eating a meal in a restaurant or when they're running off because they're late for an appointment, and they stick something in front of them and expect them to sign it or to engage in a conversation. Does that bother you?
That doesn't happen to me very much. I'm happy to say I'm a character actor, so I get left alone. People say, I know you're from somewhere. Where do I know you're from? So I come in here a lot. But the other day, I was leaving a restaurant the other day, and this has never happened to me before. And a middle-aged woman comes running over to me and says, Alan, she gives me a huge hug. And I'm caught in this embrace of this woman, and I thought I knew her for a minute. And then it turned out that she had just seen a movie of mine and thought she had the right to be my pal now.
Although you did tell a funny story about somebody saying, "I saw you in the movies." And you said, "Well, I wasn't in that movie." He said, "No, I saw you in the movie." And it was turned out he saw you in the movie theater?
Yeah, he saw me sitting on the steps with my son Adam when he was about 11. And that's where he saw me.
You won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for your portrayal of the heroin-addicted, sex-crazed grandfather in Little Miss Sunshine in 2007. And we'd like to play a little clip from that.
Perfect, perfect. You're the world champion growler. Time for your beauty rest. Get in there.
What did you think when you first read that script?
Oh, I thought it was one of the best scripts I'd ever read.
And did you know when you took the role that it had Oscar potential?
I tell you, that never enters my mind. It's either something I want to do or something I don't want to do.
Well, I imagine it doesn't enter your mind because you were nominated for an Oscar in, 1967? The Russians Are Coming, and then nothing until...
No, that's not true. I got another nomination for The Heart of the Lonely Hunter about 4 or 5 years afterwards.
And is the Oscar really important? Because, you know, it's
that's what they tell me.
Did it change your life?
It didn't change anything, except now when I hear my name mentioned, I have two more words connected to it. Oscar winner Alan Arkin. I have four names instead of two.
But you've said that the only part of the awards you really enjoy is getting nominated, not winning?
No, because being nominated, first of all, comes as a surprise. It's a delightful surprise. Usually doesn't enter my mind. I don't know whether it does other people's, but it never enters my mind. And then second of all, winning puts you in a place of isolation, or so you think. Losing puts you in a place of now you think you're a failure, and both are lies. What everybody who knows anything about science knows is that there is no such thing as isolation. So, not being nominated means that you're part of a group of people of an experience who mostly you admire, if not all of them. And it's inclusive. Winning is exclusive, and losing is exclusive, and it's ridiculous.
And invariably,
and who has the right to say? I mean, who's
invariably the actor that I thought, or actress, or whatever it is, the film that was my favorite doesn't win.
Yeah,
it's nice that they were nominated. In some cases, they weren't nominated. If you go through the history of American film or foreign films, for that matter, and look at the Oscars. Yeah. Often the greatest classics never were even nominated.
Right. I mean, Grand Illusion, which is one of the maybe 10 best movies of all time, it practically got booed off the stages in France when it was made. Not because it has any scatological thing or bad. It's an exquisite taste, but just politically, they were incensed by it
because it humanized the German head of the. Of the POW camp, played magnificently by Eric von Stroheim. Yeah. Well, you're a self-described film junkie. So do you see an awful lot of movies?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Well, we don't have an operating television set, so we watch a lot of movies instead.
Foreign films or mostly Hollywood films?
It doesn't matter. As long as I hear something interesting about them, we'll watch them. We're falling in love with Indian films these days. The kind of sweep and incredible freedom they have in their films, that the unrestricted sense of psychology that we don't have. Our psychology is kind of tight now, and they have sweeping ideas of how things can go and where they can go.
So you like it when they suddenly burst into song?
I love it.
With the same woman singing all the women's parts.
Yeah, I think it's great.
And so you don't limit yourself to the great classics. You you are open to any film, any time?
No, I'm not. I don't like mainstream hits. I love learning about the world's culture from seeing films from all over the world. Some of the Iranian films have blown us away in the past 10 years.
One of the great thrills of my life was Abbas Kiarostami was a guest on the show.
I don't know who he is.
He's probably the greatest Iranian filmmaker.
Wait a minute.
Taste of Cherry and all of those.
Wait a minute. What about, I'm terrible with names.
Mahmalbaf. Anyway.
Anyway, okay. So suddenly
great films are made in places that you didn't expect. It used to be the United States and France and Italy.
Yeah, Russia.
And now it's more likely to be Taiwan Iran and some
South
Burkina
America.
Faso or something.
Yeah, it's a lot of great movies out there from around the world.
You write in the book that you made friends with the eventual director of Second City when you both drew up a list of your 20 favorite movies, and they turned out to be exactly the same.
Exactly the same, yeah.
That's almost impossible.
Almost impossible. And to this day, we still feel exactly the same way about the films.
Now, you mentioned your kids. All three of your sons became actors.
God,
were you surprised? A lot of actors tell me they try to discourage their kids from going to show business.
Well, I guess I learned from my father not to either encourage or discourage them from anything that was creative and in an interest of theirs. I tried to keep myself out of it as much as possible in terms of what their choices were.
But you have worked with them.
I've worked with all of them, and I have had nothing but extraordinarily wonderful experiences with all of them in working situations.
And you wrote a one-act play, and your son Tony starred in that.
Well, the two of us, yeah. We were both in it.
So that must have been fun as well.
It was great, yeah. I love working with my kids.
But your wife is not an actress.
Nope. She was a psychotherapist and just decided she'd had enough of it and now is living a glorious life, doing whatever she wants, whenever she wants to.
Does she involve herself in these improvisation workshops?
Yeah, she organizes them and then takes all of them. And without being an actress, I have in 200-some-odd workshops, I have never seen her off for 1 second. It's kind of miraculous. And I think maybe it's partly because she doesn't want to be an actress.
And are you surprised by the kinds of people who show up?
No.
Because it's not just aspiring actors.
No, I love it. I like as much variety as possible. What I am surprised by is my snap judgments about what I think people are going to be able to do and then seeing what happens to them in the course of a 2-day workshop. That surprises me all the time.
Has acting helped you at all as a writer?
I have no idea. I would have no way of knowing.
Because a lot of actors wind up writing books, often writing novels, because they find themselves find it easy for them to become the characters that they're inventing.
I think improvisation probably has helped me as a writer more than acting, because that gave me a sense of the what part language plays in human experience.
Do you think your teachers at Bennington were surprised when the first book came out?
I never thought about that. The first book was so short. I don't know if any of my teachers have ever even noticed it. It was written for my youngest son, Tony, when he was about 3.
That was a children's book.
Yeah.
Alan Arkin will be speaking with Jeffrey Lyons and signing books on Sunday at 7:30 at the 92nd Street Y. For tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. His book, An Improvised Life, a memoir, is published by DiCapo, and it has been my great pleasure to have you on our show today.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.